My name is John Schramm, and the title of this session is It Time for a Confessing Movement? And I have put in parenthesis, in the United States of America. It seems to me that we ought to be talking about our own country this morning when we ask that question. This is my last session at Holden this go-round. We've been here 2 weeks, and I have been firm to my commitment that I would begin each session with a few poems from Gerhard Frost from a book, Seasons of a Lifetime. They have each time connected somewhat with the topic for the day, but I will admit that I've read them primarily because I like them and want to share them with you, and that's certainly true of the first one this morning. I don't think it has anything especially to do with the confessing movement, but it's one of my favorites in the book. She colored a giraffe today, one ear pink, the other green, a tail of blue, the body brown, spots of many colors. She brought her joyful offering into the world of grown-ups, and the first grown-up to see it said, "No one has ever seen a giraffe like that." "Isn't that too bad?" was all she said. The next one does have a little more pointed reference to today. My country, my dear homeland, is sick when she's a bastion for the rich and no refuge for the poor. When fulfillment is a luxury for the few and hope dies of starvation, in heartless success is always failure. And the last one has some reference to the topic, but is also just vintage Gerhard Frost, finding truth in the simplest of things and the simplest of daily actions. Today, I learned a lesson, the simplest kind of lesson, from a fruit jar cover. My first turn was wrong, but I was stubborn. And I was strong. The second was more wrong because I was strong. And now it's stuck. How sad to be strong and stubborn when you're wrong. There are many times at Holden when the theme of a session is in the form of a question. My hunch is most of the time it isn't really a question in the mind of the presenter. He or she has the answer. And it's just a way to kind of come at you and to get under your radar and to say, "Let's talk, but I really know what the truth is." That was true the other night. Is Lutheran spiritual direction an oxymoron? It was just a way to ask the question. What I wanted to say was the Lutheran Church would be far richer if we had what's historically known as spiritual direction as one of the ministries of the church. I'm convinced of that, but I phrased it in the form of a question. Today, it's honestly a question. Is it time for a confessing movement? You should know at the beginning that my paycheck is as an assistant to the bishop of the Minneapolis Area Synod. So if I had had an answer, it is time for a confessing movement, I certainly should not be in the job I'm in. I work in the heart of the bureaucracy of the institutional church. But if I was completely convinced that the answer is no, it's not time for a confessing movement, I wouldn't be wrestling with some real questions in my own life, including, should that be where I'm working? I can tell you, it's honestly a question for me this morning. So what I want to do is not convince you of an answer, but convince you that it is an important question. That's the goal for today, to sharpen the question. If you've never asked that question, I'm not sure that you're being faithful to a time when I believe we all ought to be asking it. Do you understand my preface to today? I honestly can tell you that it's still a question for me. Okay. I don't think, however, we will even know how to ask the question if there's not some definition of terms before we start. I hope it doesn't feel like you're back in school, but I just am not sure that we all are totally fluent with things like status confessionis, kairos time, confessing movement, and confessing church. So let me do a little bit of explanation. How many have heard the phrase status confessionis? Oh. Well, it certainly takes the pressure off of me. I know more about it than you do. Jim Nestigan from the seminary came to Trinity Lutheran Congregation where I'm a pastor, and he did an adult forum, and he said, today we have a really exciting topic, status confessionis, and everybody's head just went. But then when he raised the issues that it raises, it was an exciting session. Status confessionis is a Lutheran term, or at least evangelical term, that came out of the Reformation. It is a way by which the church, and I mean in the broadest decision-making entity that the church has, for us in the Lutheran church, and I know some of you aren't Lutherans, but it's a good way to give you an illustration, it would be the Lutheran World Federation. That's the broadest representative gathering we ever have. A way in which the Lutheran church could say, in our time, there is an issue so important to the integrity of the gospel and so important to your being faithful that at this point it has been raised and has the status of a confession. It becomes the mark of whether or not you are really Christian. I don't want to spend a long time, but you have to understand that. For instance, we could have a discussion here, a forum, and disagree considerably on some social issue and not be able to say, that puts you outside the church. In fact, if someone said that, I think everybody in the room, including those who disagreed or agreed with him, would say, hey, wait a minute. We believe in Jesus Christ. We have a difference on this opinion. Wait a minute. On this, if we say, no, it's a matter of a status confessionis, it has the status of a confession, you could technically say you are outside of what it means to be Orthodox, faithful, and really Lutheran on this issue. We've done it once in like 300 years, so it doesn't happen often. Does anybody now know the issue that it was done on at the Lutheran World Federation within the last dozen years? Apartheid in South Africa. Opposition to apartheid has the status of a confession. It is so contrary to the gospel, so contrary to the fact that the gospel of Jesus Christ breaks down the barriers between race, that you have to be opposed to it if you want to be faithful Christian. So that if someone comes up to you and says, those people in South Africa, they're going to prison, but it's not because of their Christian faith, it's because of their politics of working against apartheid, you can, for once in your life, say, you can't separate the faith and politics in South Africa on apartheid, the Lutheran World Federation, and give a lecture on status confessionis. Okay? It has the status of a confession. Secondly, kairos. Kairos is a Greek word for time. In fact, the Greek is a little richer than we because there are at least two words for time. There may be more, but my Greek has two words. Chronos, that's chronology, and that you measure by the length of it. Chronos. Kairos you tend to measure by the fullness of it, the fullness of time, by its depth, not by how long it lasts. So in Greek, you can be talking about two different kinds of time. In English, we have only one word. But kairos right now has a very particular, specific meaning. There have been three kairos documents. The first one came from South Africa. The second one came from Central America. And the third one, the only one I brought, they are all printed and available. The only one I brought is Road to Damascus, and I'll try to be technically correct as I tell you where this one came from. It came from 2.5 years of bubbling within theologians and base Christian communities in 7 nations, 3 of them in Central America, Nicaragua, Guatemala, El Salvador, 2 in Southern Africa, South Africa and Namibia, South Korea, and the Philippine Islands. It is a statement by Christians in these 7 nations that say it's a kairos time. It's a time, a special time of grace and opportunity when we are called to speak our faith. So kairos works into, is it time for a confessing movement, by saying it's a particular kind of time. It's a time when it's probably always kairos time, but the events, where we live and when we live, call for a new commitment to discerning the times and for acting faithfully. Okay. Thirdly, and I made a separation between confessing movement and confessing church. Again, the word is not necessarily self-evident. We are a confessing church. We confess our sins. And that's one of the reasons, that's one of the meanings of confessing, even in this technical way we're using it. And we confess our faith, affirm our faith, always. And that's one of the ways that it's using it here. But it becomes specifically, historically, a technical term when the church, the institutional church, the mainline church, you call it whatever, I think you know what I mean, the denominations, the church in institutional form, is not faithfully carrying out the gospel in the midst of the culture in which it lives, at least by those who are declaring themselves a confessing movement. This is a very important part. If you were in class and the teacher said that, you would know this is going to be on the test. A very important part. A confessing movement and kairos time emerge not because of the extent of the evil. People live in oppressive, evil systems a lot of time. That's not necessarily kairos time and time for a confessing movement. A confessing movement or a confessing church emerges when the church is not faithful and speaks out against the evil in a particular time. Do you feel the difference? For instance, the Lutheran Church in Namibia, as a church, as a Lutheran church, speaks out against the evil of apartheid and exists as a resisting church to the oppressive system. They don't need a confessing movement within it. The church is not enculturated. It is faithful to the gospel and it's under persecution. So you would ask, is it time for a confessing movement? Not in a country like Namibia, even though the oppression is horrible. You would ask, is it time for a confessing movement when the institutional church has become enculturated to the point that you don't think it's speaking truth to power? Important difference. In fact, probably in the history of the church is in more trouble when it is under the possibility of being seduced than when it's in the position of being persecuted. And the confessing movements arise primarily when the church is so enculturated that you can hardly tell the difference between the church and the culture around it. The Christendom is when a confessing movement arises. Okay? Are you with me? I don't want to spend too long, but I want you to know this or the session doesn't make sense. And remember, there's only one point to the session to help you sharpen the question so that you can ask, is it time for a confessing movement? Why do I have a separate category, confessing church? If there has been a kind of movement and a committee of correspondence, that was the phrase used by the confessing church in Germany under the Nazi regime before they became a church. If they have decided, yes, we have, for the sake of Jesus Christ, we have to speak out and make a break with the institutional church and become a confessing church with some way in which you organize, have an underground seminary like Dietrich Bonhoeffer taught in, have some kind of training for the pastors and some kind of communication, then you have become church. To know why that doesn't happen often, simply when somebody disagrees with the institutional church and thinks it could be shaped up a little bit. Confessing Church says, we are the church and you are not. And doesn't that sound arrogant? It does. You have to really be convinced that in spite of all of the people that you probably still know and respect who disagree with you, and in spite of the arrogance and that you could be disillusioned yourself and have an inflated ego in this whole thing, you stand up and say, we are the church, this is the church, and you are no longer church. Very decisive act. And they did it in Nazi Germany. And it doesn't happen unless you've determined that it's Kairos time and unless you are saying there is something where opposition to that, it's so idolatrous and it's so evil that opposition to that is necessary in order to be faithful. I'm going to come back to Jim Nestegan only because I told you it was a good session and it was more exciting than people thought. When he got to one possibility for a confessing movement and the reason or the need for status confessionis in the United States today, if there was one issue that was probably the potential issue where we would say opposition to that is a matter of status confessionis, what do you think it was?
The name of God.
The name of God? I'm sorry, what do you mean by that? Yes?
Well, I'm just guessing from what I know of Nestegan, that I would guess he would go for some theological point, like how we address God.
Oh, I see. How we address God. No. I would not have been surprised either. Okay. She knows Jim Nestegan, by the way.
Consumption.
Consumerism. Materialism. He said it is now idolatrous. And as soon as something is potentially idolatrous, Lutherans could pick up on the whole environmental movement and our consumerism and our materialism from the path of status confessionis and relate to Lutherans. And it would be our unique way of having the Pope speak ex cathedra or the bishops have a pastoral letter. What we do is begin to talk status confessionis. And Jim Nestegan said consumerism is the one that could be idolatrous. Do you get some sense now of what we're talking about in the way of these issues? Yes.
What would you say with respect to a confessing movement in Protestantism, and I know more about the Lutheran tradition,
yep,
but I think it's happened in other mainline denominations where new expressions of the Lutheran Church began after the merger, for instance.
Yes.
And some of them, as I understand them, do really say in their statement of doctrine that ELCA, for instance, is not,
yes,
the church. Were they,
yes,
confessing,
okay,
a church?
I put this up on the board after the Bible study, and a pastor walked through and said, oh, that was the question at St. Olaf in early June.
Right. Well,
all right. That was 900 people. About as male as the Jewish Sanhedrin, by the way, and mostly 40 to 60, somewhat shook by a lot of things, but talking theology. And to a certain extent, I think it was more theological differences within the church than it was confessing church, but they did say the ELCA was apostate. Okay, they were using language similar to this. So you don't necessarily think in terms of only one political spectrum saying the church, we are the church and you aren't the church. But if you are within the church and have a theological debate, that's not a confessing movement, and you have to say that the church is being faithless in the midst of its present culture, not just theologically errant. Do you see what... Okay, something has to have potential idolatry and destroy the gospel. But they are using language similar. Yes, okay, good illustration, good point. Do you get the context? Because we want to do a few things now, okay? You answer this question, or you begin to get some answers to it, by asking I'm using them in a somewhat poetical way, but two basic questions. Is it time for a confessing movement? You have to say, where are we? And what time is it? Where are we living? And what's the nature of the time? In order to get, is it in fact Kairos? And are we in fact living in a culture or a system where faithfulness would demand that we are resisting it? Let me give you a couple books that were kind of surprising to me, but they were the kind of books that raised this question. I think of one especially. I'll name that because it's the clearest one. Christians and Other Aliens in a Strange Land, William Stringfellow, published by Word, Dallas, Texas. I wasn't surprised by the author, I was surprised by the publisher. What did that book in essence say? The only way we can say yes to the gospel is first to say no to this culture and to say we live in Babylon. We do not live in Jerusalem. That's the kind of question that William Stringfellow asked when he said, where do we live? I'm going to come at it a little differently. I think if you raise that question in any forum here, you would have a white knuckler at Holden. Do you know what I mean? You'd look around and the knuckles were white from people holding onto their chairs. If I understand, the only guests who left without staying for even what they had paid for was a Hiroshima-Nagasaki Vespers, where they could say Holden is un-American because part of what we had done in our history was called into question. You aren't into a real good discussion at the local Rotary or Kiwanis Club if you come in and give this as your speech. I'm aware of that. I do think, however, it's an important question. I'd like you to move into this experiment with me a little bit. I'm going to try to put it on the board so you can see it and hopefully get a better sense of it. The Christian Church has had some ages, and I'm going to put on the board first the Apostolic Age. I'm going to put a typical congregation, and then I'm going to put the boundary where that congregation felt that they entered an alien or a foreign or a pagan or an alternative world. Where did they feel that they entered that? Right outside the circle of our community. Wasn't that correct? You entered this by way of a catechumenate and a baptism. You entered from a pagan culture into that, and daily you probably went out and came back into it to do your work, but you really did know that we as a Christian community lived an alternative lifestyle to the world around us. In other words, the mission field is the whole world. And there was one of these in Ephesus, and they wrote letters to one in Rome, and they had this struggling one in Corinth that always had a little trouble with their morality and other things. And the Philippians, they were doing a little bit better. The only squabble they had was between Syntyche and Euodia, and Paul wanted them to agree, but they didn't have the troubles of Corinth. But do you get the picture? In fact, one of the ways to get the picture of just how close the boundary of the mission field was, how close it was to the perimeter of our circle, study the baptism in the early Christian church. Dan Erlander has some marvelous tapes here because he got fascinated with the customs, the ritual. Dan likes ritual of the early baptism. It was very symbolic. You entered down into the waters of baptism. You literally drowned and rose again. But even the direction was important, because before you went into the waters, you went from the west and you went toward the east. Where was the emperor? Over there in Rome. And if Dan's correct, before you entered the water, first you turned toward Rome and you went then you turned and naked entered the water and came out with a new righteousness and as a new person with a new identity toward the east. You said no. Jesus is Lord was the first affirmation of faith, and very political. It was an alternative to Caesar is Lord. And if you didn't go along with Caesar is Lord and have, it didn't take long, just a pinch of incense and you got your card punched once a year and said Caesar is Lord. But if you didn't do that, you might be dipped in tar, put on a stake and lit for the patio party. That's literally true. to give the lights for the patio party somewhere. It was a very costly entrance into here. You knew the difference. So, was there need for a confessing movement? Absolutely not. Let's get another image. Christendom came. These are broad strokes, right? We're going to have to, a historian will die. Historians are those who say as recently as 2,000 years ago. And
well, you should be married to a geologist.
Touché. I hope I do justice to Christendom. Christendom had parishes. And the parish was that cluster of Christians who worshiped at a particular place, but it was geographically all those Christians who lived in that place, and the borders of the mission field were way out somewhere in a land that wasn't Christian. You sent foreign missionaries to some land that wasn't Christian, but your mission here in this culture was to do your daily job because it's a Christian land. Do you begin to? I described the baptism here. Do you remember it? To Rome, down into the water, up, decisive break. When you get to here is when the pastor gets a phone call from somebody who says, "When can I get my baby done?" You know what I mean? Baptism is, well, naming the child, and, well, let's let Uncle Dudley be the sponsor. He's a likable old guy. And you, how different Christendom with a local geographic parish in a Christian, quote, country, where your ministry is not to go out here and confront an alien world, but to do your job, pay your taxes, pay for the president, all the other things that happen when the whole era here is Christian, and the mission field is far away. Free ice cream cone to the best drawing of where we are today in the Lutheran Church or in the Christian Church in the United States of America. Do either of those fit?
No.
You say no? Does anybody think either of those fits?
Yes, I think your second one fits.
Still fits. Okay. Does someone want to take on Al in any way about it not fitting?
I don't want to say you can almost do the reverse.
Yeah, put the green circle.
Yeah, is that Christendom is everywhere, and that with the idea of a confessing movement, you're actually working from within, wanting to go out and destroy.
Can you draw it? I'm not sure I get, but I think a drawing would be helpful. Here, I'll give you the green one. The green one is the boundary, okay? Of where the mission field is where. Here the mission field is right outside of the given congregation. Here the mission field is outside of our Christian country.
The colors are actually reversed.
Okay? So the parish is the whole world.
Mission field. Is
to work within. Okay, all right. Do you like that drawing? Does it disagree with Al? Al, can you go along with this drawing?
Well, I wouldn't say that the whole world is Christendom. You've got the Buddhist world, and the Communist world. So I wouldn't think we think the whole world is somehow Christian.
Okay. Why are some of you uncomfortable with the second drawing and the continuation of our assumption in the USA? Remember, we're talking more about the USA. Were you talking about the USA with your big circle?
I would agree that, yes, I think in a worldview there is other things that mitigate it. But I would say within the United States,
okay,
or within, you know, Western society, that's a more definitive diagram.
Is there anyone who wants to articulate some discomfort with this being a Christian nation?
John, I don't know how you would draw it, but I think one of the important characteristics today is the privatization of religion, so that the boundary...
Good timing. Go ahead. Just wait a second. It's going along.
So that maybe what you have to do is draw a little parish circle, and then lots of little circles in the middle.
Okay, a parish circle, a solid parish circle here?
Yeah, with lots of little circles in the middle.
Dotted or whole?
Well, it doesn't matter, to indicate the individual members.
Okay.
But make some of them go over the edge of the circle.
Okay.
Okay, so that the parish boundary, the individuals don't necessarily feel like they're making any, there's no difference. Because religion is all me. And when I'm in the congregation, and when I'm out in the world, it's the same thing.
Okay.
So no mission is needed.
Could you justify that theologically, or you're trying to describe it sociologically?
I'm not giving that as a good thing, but a descriptive thing.
Do you understand that Deanne's drawing is essentially trying to get at, we are so individualistic in this culture that the drawing has to be, and instead of being an entity, which would be a community, it's a cluster of individuals. In fact, you could even question the circle, and just kind of, Robert Bella in the book Habits of the Heart says that congregations are probably not communities. They are lifestyle enclaves. And he says the reason that we have so much trouble in this culture, it's so individualistic. Yes, we have groups, but what they are groups because people have found that their individualism is served well in groups. And then we wonder why our congregation isn't a community. Deanne is saying you have to sketch that somehow or you don't get the present reality.
I got another one.
Good.
Since I'm a great graphic artist. This is
that's the boundary of the mission field should be outside of that, okay?
And I would draw it like this.
Okay.
Or, I mean, with variations of that theme. Sometimes it's like this. Anyway, I guess along the themes of the individualistic idea that the church as community or as institution, that the boundaries, you can't distinguish, they're crossing over.
Okay, all right.
John, you said, we consider the nation Christian.
Yes.
I certainly don't consider the whole Christian. It's a question of whether or not you think of kind of conceptually or loosely you think of Christianity is permeating the whole of Western culture. You know, assumptions of Christianity have permeated the whole of Western culture to a degree. But historically, today, there's almost no place where anything is Christian, in my view.
Okay.
Because we are idolaters. And we baptize the idolatry and call it Christian.
So
you have a real problem penetrating. None of these institutions really penetrate or exemplify what it would mean to be faithful today, in my judgment.
Okay, I'm not sure then you could hold with the Christendom model that I drew. I think you'd want, and some of these are really good attempts. I don't know how many ice cream cones I have to give. But I do leave on the bus at 15:15. I'll tell the snack bar. We'll take a vote as to which one gets an ice cream cone. Anybody else want to try? Yes.
John, when I was in college...
Can you see it at all?
Oh, yeah, okay. Right. When I was in college, I did a study of slavery, and how the Christian church actually underpinned the institution and gave it a sense of rightness.
Yes.
And how in South Africa that happened.
Yes.
Okay, well, it seems to me with the theology of glory and many of the things that are being said in Christendom today, we are somehow underpinning the the alien or other culture we live in by saying, if you believe, if you do this, if you are Christian, you have a right to this life. God will bless you.
Uh-huh.
You get what you want.
Uh-huh.
So I think that theology that is prevalent in many churches that we call Christian in our culture is actually allowing our culture to exist. And I know how to draw that.
Okay. My, I wish we had a lot more time to do this. I think this would be the most fun of my 2 weeks at Holden if we really had a longer workshop and worked with some conceptual way to try to get. I think there will be, almost inevitably, will be some people who feel that faithfulness will be to return to one or the other of these two previous models. Either back to the apostolic age, there are always some who want to return to that and say, this is when the church was faithful and maybe the only time, and kind of draw this tight circle. Probably most of us will want to return in some way, whether we articulate it or not, to be much more like Christendom. I think the 50s were very much Christendom, church growth movement, new churches, optimism about this country, about the coming, if not utopia, or the kingdom of God on earth. In my lifetime, that seemed like the most attempt to replicate this growth of parishes within a Christian nation. I don't know what has changed that the most. I don't know what has changed it the most for you. Can you name when some of the kind of absolute loyalty and pride in this being a Christian nation got a little crumbly for you? Was it a particular event, or was it a time in your life, or your, yeah?
I think our recognition of the fact that this isn't a country made up of nuclear white middle class families. I think that I at least grew up in a very small, tight community where everything was rosy for all of us. And everybody else in the country was just like me, and everything was great. And as that crumbled, as we became aware of poverty, as we became aware of oppression of people because of their race or gender or sexual orientation, we began to, or divorce or whatever, we began to realize that no, it isn't all light and roses. And a lot of people respond to that by saying, if we didn't create that, then there's something wrong with the church that espouses that.
Okay. Yes.
I guess I'm uncomfortable with calling it just a Christian nation, because for one thing, that I believe that this nation was founded on the concept of religious freedom, and that doesn't mean Christianity and denominations thereof. It can be any spiritual background,
uh-huh.
Buddhist
okay.
or Hindu, and I think that is one of the reasons why people of all different religions all over the world are so attracted to come to this country, and they come to get rid of escape the oppression that's in their own country and practice whatever religion, be it Christian or other religions here. And I think that we are very non-inclusive when we call it a Christian country.
Okay, that's a different perspective. Thank you. Let me give you the difference for me as to how it feels. The congregation I grew up in, I never remember one time that the church had a viewpoint different from the U.S. government. I don't remember it as a boy. We had an honor flag for all of those young men, it was all men, from our congregation who were in the country service. We didn't have a single conscientious objector to World War II. That's when I was growing up. I don't think we had a single conscientious objector. Deanne can check me on this. I'm now in a Lutheran congregation, very Lutheran, old Lutheran Free Church. I don't think there is a single member of the church who was in favor of contra-aid or the U.S. policy in Central America. Not a single member out of 375, at least that I know of. And vocally critical of the U.S. government. Still faithful U.S. citizens, but vocally critical of some of the things our country does. That's a very, very dramatic shift for me to still be part of the Lutheran Church and to have that kind of change of vocal, part of the sermons, part of the discussion groups, and to have the Center for Global Education with trips going down to Central America all the time, very much part of the church because the director of that is a member of the church, and we support the work. That's part of what I feel as a difference in my own lifetime. All I'm saying today is, if you're not comfortable with the drawing of what Christendom is, and that the only ministry we're called to is to do our job well and to be good citizens of this country, it's a way to say that is, you have to ask then, how will the church be faithful when there are some things that have to be addressed? And if the institutional church is so enculturated that it's not addressing them, then it's time for a confessing movement. That's really all I'm trying to say today. Now, Dan Spencer had a triangle on the board. He had the rich people, and he had the army, and the third part of that was the church in Central America, especially before Medellin, 1968, and before the papacy had more talk about the poor. The major revolution in Central America was that the church no longer supported this link between the rich, and Dan even had all the statistics. In El Salvador, that's 11 or 14 families, very small, with the army to support them, oppressing the poor. As long as the church supported that, there wasn't much hope for a revolution. When the bishops came out with a preferential option for the poor, then the institutional church was responding to the plight of the poor and what does faithfulness to Jesus Christ mean. If they hadn't, or now if they've withdrawn from that with the new bishops and a much less aggressive official, there's no Oscar Romero right now, then the base Christian communities are really a form of a confessing movement. It maybe it's easier to see it in other countries and then come back and say, is there anything like that needed in our country? I don't think we tend to do that very often. That's why I'm raising the question today. Okay. So this one is more, where are we? Now let me give just a little bit, I'm frustrated by the clock this morning, but a little bit of what Kairos means. Probably Connie's comments are helpful. It often is the people who are being oppressed. There was also the comment up here. It's the people sometimes who are being oppressed by the system who make us more aware of what it's really like. If we are not suffering at all, we probably would vote for the continuation of the status quo. So it's the ones who are being crushed by the system who often raise their voice.
I have a drawing. I want an ice cream cone.
Oh, you have a drawing?
Yeah, circle, every other slash, black, green, black, green, black, green.
Does that help? A circle, black, green, black, green, black, green. Dotted.
What does that mean?
You're going to have to earn your ice cream cone.
It means they're so confused, they're one, and you can't tell the difference between the prophetic voice or what the church is and what the culture is. And there isn't really a mission field because neither one of them thinks either one has to change.
Let me say that we won't be getting at what I was trying to get at with the two drawings unless the drawing accurately portrays theologically and biblically what the church ought to be in relation to the culture. It would be easier to describe the present milieu of confusion with the drawing than being faithful to an understanding of, given this, this is the way the church ought to relate to the culture. That's really hard to do. It's really hard to do. I think maybe, instead of being in a new age, there was an apostolic age, it's pretty clear. In fact, you can date it, Constantine, and you started into Christendom. And it's pretty easy to draw Christendom. I think maybe instead of a new age, we're in a transition time and we don't know exactly what that's going to look like in regard to faithfulness. And the times in between the times are always hard. Always hard. In some way, the hardest. When the cultural assumptions are being challenged, you feel it right here. The things that, if there's a debate, it's very invigorating as long as the cultural assumptions are shared by both of the debaters. We can be in it and enjoy it. When the cultural assumptions are being challenged, then we feel it here and it's much more scary. And I think maybe we're in one of those times between the times. Okay?
But you don't have any question about it. We have to say no to most of the values of Western culture.
Do you?
No.
Okay. Then you are not happy with this. I keep coming back to how you could say the second drawing was faith.
That's the way people can see it.
I see. Okay. Okay.
It's not the way it ought
to be. All right. If you have to say no to most of the values of the Western culture, and the church that you belong to institutionally is not doing that, then you're ripe for asking the question, is it time for a confessing movement? Well, that's today's premise.
It is, clearly.
Yes.
I think that there's another piece to that, which is why it's hard for us to just use the two apostolic and Christendom models. And that's that some of us would say that the ideal is neither to say no nor to say yes, but some kind of transformation of what is.
Okay.
And that's really hard to draw.
Okay.
It's easy to draw, we're in conflict with the world.
Yep.
It's easy to draw, we embrace the world, but it's hard to say it's our job to transform the world.
Yep.
And so, you know, I'm thinking of Niebuhr's typology of Christ and culture, that those middle ones are always much more difficult to talk about and to draw.
Okay.
So that the strategy of saying no maybe becomes as important as saying no.
Thank you. Yes.
This may be a little bit off the subject, but recently the way that I view the church is a gathering of people who have some inkling that there's something wrong. And they don't know what it is. There's something wrong with their families, there's something wrong with themselves. There's something wrong with the society, but they don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I draw the picture.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And your particular denominations or your particular local congregations may have a distinctive part of that. In other words, if a congregation basically appeals to those who think something's wrong with themselves, and therefore it's a kind of therapeutic or a healing or a close-knit community that nurtures people, that will appeal to some, right? Others might say there's something wrong with this society. That would appeal to different kinds of people who are not working on their own problem but are able to see a wider picture or the plight of the poor or what have you. But it's an interesting description of what the church is. See, one of my premises is that the most successful churches in the United States today, statistically, are people who ignore this question and who give people what they want and who basically say you all can do well and do good at the same time and never challenge that.
Let's go back to the 30s.
And let's go back to some kind of time capsule, the 30s or something else, 50s, whatever it is. And I think basically some of what that leaves is a membership that's emotionally high and spiritually dead. Because they haven't asked the hard questions. Hutch, a third of all your offerings go to Hutch down in Wenatchee, a man who started a shelter. Remarkably interesting man. One of the first times I talked with him, he said, I've gone around to all the pulpits around Wenatchee, and there's not a single pulpit where you don't hear, we are being blessed by God, and all of the riches of these orchards and what have you is God's blessings upon it. I have not heard once in all the time I've been here that the devil gives out goodies too. He's not going to get a call to one of those churches. He's not going to get a call. When you raise the hard questions, the faith questions, you struggle with things like what is the nature of the church and the mission of the church. Okay, I just want you to hear a little bit from the people from these seven countries so you get some sense. There are four parts to The Road to Damascus. I think it costs $3 or something, and I think Jeanette has them in the bookstore. If you've never listened at all to the people from these countries, if Dan's sessions on El Salvador perked your interest a little bit of, I've got to see what that means to me, my life, our congregation. Just read what some of these people are telling, because they're really speaking to us too. Four basic premises, four chapters. Historical and political roots of the conflict. And the conflict that pains them the most is the divided church. You remember when I said, now this part's important, this is going to be on the test? What was the point?
When a woman is saying the church is not being true.
Okay, it's not the extent of the evil or the oppression, it's the faithlessness of the church in the light of the oppression or the evil. And the thing that pains the people who have come up with this statement is the divided church. What they see is, now I'm going to give you the two sides. There are two kinds of people in the world. Those who will divide the world into two kinds of people and those who refuse to ever do that. I'm aware that it's always simplistic, but it's sometimes helpful if you acknowledge that it can be sometimes helpful. You have liberation theology, black theology, feminist theology, Minjong theology, that's from Korea, still theology of the people, a theology of struggle, the church of the poor, progressive church, basic Christian communities. All of that is part of the Christian church in these countries, these seven nations. And you have, within the same countries and within the Christian church, the religious right, right-wing Christians, state theology, a theology of reconciliation, neo-Christendom, and anti-communist evangelicals. And they are split apart. They are as opposed as can be and still part of the church. That's the pain of the people who are writing. So they can ask things like this at the end of chapter 1. The conflict among Christians raises some very serious questions, which we shall have to address in the rest of this document. Is the God invoked by both sides the same God? Is God on both sides? If not, on whose side is God? What has been revealed to us about God in Jesus? Okay. Let me give you it from chapter 2, called The Faith of the Poor, just a few things. This is their accounting, recounting of their life in the faith. The Jesus who was preached to us was barely human. He seemed to float above history, above all human problems and conflicts. In fact, his death had nothing to do with historical conflicts, was a human sacrifice to placate an angry God. Walt Bowman did some of that last week with the history of the vicarious atonement, instead of it being a political event when Jesus was crucified, or at least including the politics of it. What we discovered, this is now as they grew in the faith and in the scriptures, scripture is very important to the life of the base Christian communities. What was discovered was that Jesus was one of us, born in poverty, did not become incarnate as a king or nobleman, but as a poor, one of the poor and oppressed. He took sides with the poor, supported their cause, blessed them. The reign of God is like the Jubilee year of Leviticus. You remember the provisions of Jubilee year? Debts are canceled. Land is returned to the previous owner. This is every 50 years. Prisoners are released. The reign of God in Jesus, that Jesus was prophesying, was a coming new world order. His preaching was subversive. Then the last part of this chapter. God is on the side of the poor, the oppressed, the persecuted. When this faith is proclaimed and lived in a situation of political conflict between the rich and the poor, when the rich and the powerful reject this faith and condemn it as heresy, we can read the signs and discern something more than a crisis. We're faced with kairos, with a moment of truth, with a time for decision, a time of grace, a God-given opportunity for conversion and hope. Then they have a chapter on the prophetic mission. How should we explain silence and uninvolvement? The reason lies in a choice of the privileged and powerful, a conscious defense of the status quo. And they call that a sin of idolatry. So they are beginning to set this kind of, some of the aspects of we are the church and the other side is not the church. They also say, this is point 65, these are just paragraph points that are very easy to read but not always easy to respond to. Right-wing Christianity is being promoted with vigorous and expensive campaigns in all of our countries and in almost all Christian traditions, Catholic, Reformed, Lutheran, Anglican, Evangelical, and Pentecostal. sometime you ought to ask people who have lived there whether that's fair or whether that's only from the side of these people. And then I simply want to bring the conclusion, because I can't do credit to the Kairos document or to the Road to Damascus in 2 minutes. Our oppressors organize themselves nationally and internationally. We cannot afford to face the struggle separately. Solidarity is not optional if we are to promote the cause of God in the world. We call on fellow Christians in the third world, also in the industrial capitalist countries and in the socialist countries, to build a network of exchange and cooperation. What they're calling for, as they say, this is Kairos time for us, and that we have come through this through prayer and study of Scripture, is what kind of response would we have? If we felt that that world situation was such that we needed to respond, that's the kind of time when you ask, is it time for a confessing movement? I want to give you, it's a quarter of, so we're going to have to end it very quickly. I want to say that the group of which I'm a part, Community of St. Martin in Minneapolis, has a 6-page paper. We have tried to struggle with this question. We think that's what it means to be a confessing movement at this time, is to ask that question is to really struggle with it. And so we have a draft of Confession and Kairos, a Time of Decision. And I can summarize very, very briefly what this is sent out to people saying, this is what we see, what do you see? Could you respond? Is it a time for us to at least ask this question in a more open way? Sojourners Magazine is going to run some of the kinds of questions that we ask here. Jim Wallace and several others came to Minneapolis last December and met with some of the people from our community. Let me give you the quickest summary I've ever done of this paper that took us months of struggling. The introduction to the paper has that the present historical moment is the kind of time when we think you can ask, is it Kairos? And we give a definition of Kairos, of status confessionis, and of what we mean by confession. I've already done that. The historical precedents we name are the Barmen Declaration in Germany before the confessing movement there, where they said Jesus is Lord, and it was basically a theological statement. Then South Africa Kairos, Central America Kairos, and the Road to Damascus. Then we have four present situations in regard to the United States of America and the way we live, an official policy which we think you have to be opposed to if you're going to be faithful in our day. One is the rich-poor gap or the economics, especially the changes in the last 10 years in regard to social programs and other things. So we have a statement of the church. There is talk, including Jim Wallace when he goes around with this Let Justice Roll, there's talk about a second Reformation, where the first Reformation was an important contribution by Martin Luther. The second Reformation has to ask the question, is it good news for the poor? That in this world, at the present time, in everything that we do and in all of our programs, one of the questions must be, is it good news for the poor? And have that as one of the test marks. So that's the first point. The second one, and probably the one that triggered this paper the most, is low-intensity conflict. I need another show of hands. How many know what low-intensity conflict is? Okay. That's a tragedy. That you didn't know the phrase status confessionis, no problem. That you don't even know the phrase low-intensity conflict, that's a tragedy. That is now the official policy of the Pentagon. It is now not only in Jack Nelson Palmyre's books, Low Intensity Conflict, the U.S. War Against the Poor, it's in the Star Tribune of Minneapolis, when the Pentagon admits that our present policy is not all-out war, but that the condition of the world should be a kind of constant war, and not any U.S. white middle-class soldiers coming home in body bags, but that other people are going to fight it for us. And it includes officially terrorism. You take the justifiable war criteria, and low intensity conflict is just flat out absolutely unjust war. If you were a good Lutheran, you would have to say, I'm a conscientious objector to the present policy of the United States of America. I meant to say that as strongly as my voice said it. That's probably the main thing that triggered. But we got two more. Our consumptive patterns and the ecological crisis in the United States, and so far very little except hype The greenhouse effect has had two primary reactions. That's better sunglasses and better air conditioners. And we think there's something more creative than that. That one was a little facetious, excuse me. And the fourth is our deployment of, manufacture, and at least having first strike weapons. The fact that we haven't used them yet, we think, is a kind of fine line in the moral deliberation. But if you take all four of those, we are saying it's time to at least look at. The church should respond, and if the church doesn't, maybe it's time for a confessing movement. I'm sorry the bell has ended it, but I hope it sharpened for you a little bit the question, and you can tell that my question at the beginning puts me in a dilemma as to who pays me and where I work and what this might mean for my life. And I have a wife and family, so what it means for our life. But I hope some of the rest of you join the joy of the present struggle of what faithfulness means in the USA today. A great way to end my time at Holden Village, right?